Good afternoon and welcome to Senior Matters. I'm Gavin Dahl, sitting in for our regular host Diane Johnson this month with a special program about the future of universal healthcare in the U.S., featuring Ross Brooks, CEO of Mountain Family Health, live in the studio with me, and also by phone, reporter Joshua Holland, a contributor to The Nation magazine and Rolling Stone, who hosts the Politics and Reality radio show. Joshua wrote a great story for The Nation magazine last month, warning that while the healthcare debate is moving to the left, if progressives don't start sweating the details, we're going to fail yet again. Thanks for joining us, Joshua.
Hey, thank you for having me, Gavin.
And I also reached out to health policy advocate and businessman Ross Brooks to bring a local perspective here in the Roaring Fork Valley. Thanks so much for coming into the studio, Ross.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Gavin.
Ever since 2003, Michigan Congressman John Conyers introduces a Medicare for All bill each year in the U.S. House of Representatives. This year, it has attracted 117 co-sponsors and counting, the most ever. And it's not just the House. Three potential candidates for president in 2020 who serve in the U.S. Senate are now backing single payer. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren announced last week that she's supporting Medicare for All, saying, quote, "I believe it's time to take a step back and ask, what is the best way to deliver high-quality, low-cost health care to all Americans? Everything should be on the table, and that's why I'm co-sponsoring Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill." Warren was quick to follow California Senator Kamala Harris, who came out in support of the bill last week. This Monday, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker and Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley added their names, with Senator Merkley saying, quote, "Healthcare should be a right for every single American, not a privilege reserved for the healthy and the wealthy." And Tuesday, New York Senator Kristen Gillibrand and Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin signed on, along with Minnesota Senator Al Franken, who added, quote, "I strongly believe we must pursue bipartisan policies that improve our current healthcare system for all Americans, and that's exactly what we're doing right now in the Senate Health Committee." Senators Brian Schatz and Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, Senators Tom Udall and Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Senator Gene Sheehan of New Hampshire, and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts are all now signed on as well. But that's only 17 out of 100 in the Senate. Some suggest expanding Medicare, which kicks in at age 65, to Americans 55 and older could be the solution. Josh, you write that the activist left, which has a ton of energy at the moment, has, for the most part, failed to grapple with the difficulties of transitioning to a single-payer system. Can you explain?
Yeah, in the activist community, I think that the prevailing view is that the obstacles to switching to a single-payer system are the insurance companies and other shareholders, other vested interests, and ideological qualms from the Democratic Party, opposition from the Republicans, and that if you could wish away those things, the transition would be relatively simple and could be done relatively rapidly. My concern is that any policy that takes the 68% or so of the adult population, the non-elderly population, that has insurer-based health coverage right now, and you mandate that they switch to something new, you will also get significant public opposition. And this is something that we're not factoring in by and large. And I should say that I think that Sanders' bill is a positive step, despite the fact that it does have this four-year transition period where everybody, except for veterans and people who get health care through the Indian Health Care Service, would be switched over into Medicare. I think it's a really good thing to expand the conversation beyond the parameters of where it's been around the Affordable Care Act.
That's Joshua Holland. He's a contributor to The Nation magazine and Rolling Stone. And my guest in the studio is Ross Brooks, CEO of the nonprofit Mountain Family Health. Ross, you've been very outspoken on the need for policy change, including with your editorial in the Glenwood Springs Post Independent earlier this year titled "Gutting Health Insurance for the Poor Will Not Improve the System." But you've also been modeling a community health approach to care, serving over 18,000 patients across Garfield, Eagle, Pitkin, and Rio Blanco counties. Talk about what you've learned doing this work on the ground.
Well, Thanks for having me. And what I really think, what struck me about Joshua's article is when he talks about Medicare for All not being the litmus test, but rather the belief that healthcare access for all is something that the government should provide. That really struck me, and I agreed wholeheartedly with him in his article at that point. I believe that that's core to who I am, that's core to who our organization is, and we exist to make sure that everyone has access to affordable care in the community. What we've learned is that just like taking care of your car, putting a little oil in your car up front and paying that $20 or $30 up front delays a $2,000 expenditure down the line to replace your engine. That is true about the human body as well, that an investment in primary care, in prevention, in healthy eating, in healthy living has significant benefits to control the total cost of care and keep us healthier as human beings over the long run. We've also learned at the policy level in our state last year, we had Amendment 69, which wasn't a pure single payer. People got to keep Medicare, but it aimed to cover everybody else in the community. It got crushed at the polls. It lost 79 to 21%, something like that. So I think the discussion and the dialogue about the pathway to get towards universal coverage and universal access is very worthwhile. I'm very committed to that and excited to talk a little bit more about the details of what that might mean.
Yeah, and Joshua, you say, you know, a near consensus has developed around using Medicare to achieve single-payer health care, but Medicare isn't a single-payer system. Talk about that.
Well, Medicare as it exists right now is the system that's in vague, broad strokes, like the Affordable Care Act or some of the European systems, in that there's the traditional Medicare, and then there are these Medicare Part B, Part C, Part D, these privatized plans that are regulated and have to conform to certain guidelines within the Medicare system, but they're sold by private companies and they prevent it from being a single pool of insurees. So what the Sanders bill does, what the Conyers bill does, they're both so-called improved Medicare for all. So before you even get to the point where you're extending coverage, it changes the current Medicare system so that everybody is in a traditional Medicare plan, and those traditional Medicare plans also cover additional benefits compared to where they are now. A good chunk of the Medicare population has a supplemental insurance plan to cover co-payments and also things that are not covered under traditional Medicare. There are the prescription drug plans, et cetera, et cetera. Both of the Medicare for All bills that we're looking at today cover all of those things without co-payments or deductibles. And one of the things that this is, which is a great thing to aspire to, but I think it's important to note that that is a system that is far more generous than anything that exists today in other countries. You know, most countries that we say, well, it has a single-payer universal healthcare system, they do have some percentage of healthcare costs through the private sector, out of pocket, with co-pays, with deductibles, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that I think is really challenging is that, you know, there are many countries that have enacted a national single-payer type system, but they all did it when they were spending a very, very small fraction on healthcare relative to what we spend today. So you look in Europe, all these countries, they established their healthcare systems in the aftermath of World War II. They were spending 1 or 2% of their economic output on healthcare at the time. We face a different challenge in that we're already spending an enormous fortune compared to everybody else, not only for the insurance aspect of it, but also on the cost of healthcare goods and services. So, like, you know, whatever you want to talk about, an X-ray or a pregnancy or a surgical operation, it costs far more. Devices, pharmaceuticals, they all cost more in this country by far than in other countries. So you get to this point where I fear that with this proposal, we're kind of over-promising. The Sanders proposal today doesn't have a kind of comprehensive description of how we're going to pay for all of this. So I always reject claims that we can't afford a single-payer or universal healthcare system. I think that's wrong. After all, we do pay more than everybody else
in the world
already. But at some point, you have to figure out the specifics of how to make the economics work without hitting everybody with hitting everybody in the middle class with a huge tax increase, if not for the substantive reasons and just for the politics of that.
That's Nation Magazine and Rolling Stone contributor Joshua Holland. Ross Brooks from Mountain Family Health, you're a data guy. What does the data say about both improving health at the same time that you control costs?
Well, I think the first thing is that healthcare is not free. And so no copays and no deductibles. I'm typically not supportive of that. In our organization at Mountain Family, we have a sliding fee scale for low-income families. And sometimes that slide is as low as $2, $5, $10, $20 for care. But it's important that we as consumers and patients understand there's a cost to our care and help share in that. Should we pay half of it? No. But should we share based on our ability to pay? I totally agree that we should do that. So a patient responsibility plays into this. And in the most successful European models and other models, patients have skin in the game at the end of the day. I think that's important with whatever we move forward with. I think the other thing is, if you look at how we spend our funds within healthcare, not just as a percentage of GDP, but what are we investing in healthcare? The data we've got and the experience we have through Medicaid, which is health insurance for low-income families or disabled individuals, show that if you invest in primary care and mental health and basic prevention up front, you reduce total health care expenditures over time. That's the secret sauce, just like putting oil in your car and saving your engine. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to show through a program called Medicaid Prime here in our state that's in Western Colorado, a savings of almost $60 per member per month for complex Medicaid patients, low-income adults and disabled individuals, by providing preventative primary care, behavioral health services, affordable dental services.
And their overall health is improved.
Their overall health is improved. And ultimately, what we do is we try to keep people out of the hospital. We try to help people use the emergency room less and less and instead see their primary care provider. I think one of the other keys, in addition to comprehensive primary care and spending our money there, is price transparency. So we are pretty poor consumers in healthcare, and the healthcare industry, of which I am a part, doesn't do a great job of being transparent about what things cost and what the price is. So I'm impressed with groups like in Colorado, the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare has cost tools so I can see what my MRI would cost in Aspen versus Vail versus Grand Junction versus Denver. I have on my iPhone an app called Health Advocate that allows me to see if my wife needs a CT scan, where the most cost-effective place would be to go get that.
Nice.
So those are some tools that I think, have been proven to control costs and improve health.
Just a quick lightning round for you, Ross. Give us the annual budget of Mountain Family.
About $17 million a year.
And how many staff?
175.
And you said patients, something like 18,000?
18,500 now.
Wow. And then just, Joshua, for your information, Medicaid Prime patients are showing improved outcomes, according to the state of Colorado, in diabetes management, weight assessment, and counseling, as well as antidepressant medication management. So this is an interesting program that covers things that you might not necessarily associate with, you know, standard go to the doctor because you're sick.
That's right.
I also want to ask both of you, for listeners out there who are not of age yet or who haven't ever used Medicaid or other, you know, assistance programs, help us understand, for those who don't know, the differences between Medicare, Medicaid, and, you know, private insurance or group insurance. So give us sort of the quick landscape for in case folks listening to Senior Matters on KD&K don't know those.
Great question. I'll start, and Joshua, you can correct me along the way. But Medicare is typically health insurance for those 65 and older, mm-hmm. For older adults. Medicaid is typically health insurance for lower income families. In our state in Colorado, Medicaid covers 138% of the federal poverty level and below. So to contextualize in real dollars, that means you as a single individual make less than $16,000 a year in income and you would qualify for Medicaid.
But 75% of adults in Medicaid work.
That's right.
In Colorado.
That's right, which is a stat that a lot of people don't know.
Right.
And there's sometimes Medicaid will be vilified as low-income people sucking off the system, taking advantage of taxpayers. But the real data shows that 75% of Medicaid individuals have income, have jobs, oftentimes 2 to 3 jobs. They're just very low-paying jobs that aren't a sustainable living wage.
What if you live in the Roaring Fork Valley and you make less than the living wage, but you make too much for Medicaid? Is there a sort of a donut hole there?
Yeah, there's a donut hole in there. There's a program called the Child Health Plan, CHIP, which has just been reauthorized at the federal level, I think, earlier this week. And that provides coverage up to 185, sometimes up to 200% of federal poverty. Again, not much, you know, so we're talking about maybe $24,000 a year for a single person. For a family of four, we're talking about $49,000 a year or less.
Okay.
And then the commercial market really is made up predominantly of employer-based coverage, which we have a strong history of in our nation, where employers have come forward to provide coverage for their employees. That market is shifting significantly because employers are struggling to cover the cost of that coverage and actually help their staff improve their own health.
Right.
And then we have the health insurance exchanges in many of the states, sometimes provided federally. In our state, it's provided by the state of Colorado. And so you can go online and buy a commercial plan and price shop. In theory, you can price shop. Originally, you could price shop, but
I don't know if Joshua knows this, but where we live, Joshua, where our listeners are tuned into KDNK here across 8 different FM frequencies, 4 counties, we are now down to only one provider on the exchange for the individual health marketplace here in Colorado. Joshua, had you heard about that?
I'm not familiar with Colorado, with your listening area per se, but I'm certainly aware that there are an increasing number of counties across the United States that have only one provider, and sometimes that can be a little bit deceptive in the sense that I live in New York. I buy through the individual market on the exchanges, and although there are 3 providers, really the plan that I'm looking at, given my own healthcare needs, there's really only one that offers a plan that fits my type of needs. So this is the argument, one of the best arguments for adding a public option to the existing exchanges that would assure that there is competition in every marketplace, including marketplaces where there aren't enough private insurers participating. And that's one of the proposals floating around Congress, actually, would allow insurers in different marketplaces to sell across state lines. In the case of Obamacare exchanges that don't have more than one provider.
Well, and then I just mentioned in passing that there are now some other proposals besides the Medicare for All that say, well, maybe we could just lower the age. So, for example, several kind of more moderate Democrats in the U.S. Senate have said, well, let's push for a 55 and up Medicare instead of a 65 and up Medicare. What about the flip side of this discussion, which is the party in power, the Republican Party? Joshua, what have you seen in terms of some of the proposals out there from the right, including upping the age, right, so that people could turn 65 and then no longer qualify for Medicare? They have to wait longer. Have you seen momentum for that this year?
Those types of proposals have been around for a long time. I have to say that I'm not aware of anybody pushing them right now.
Okay.
In the midst of the current debate. I think that they have actually backed off of that to some degree, and maybe that's a sign of where the political winds are blowing. We should note that there is yet another plan, another shot at the bite at the apple, if you will, in the Senate. Republicans are considering a last ditch effort to repeal Obamacare with the Cassidy Amendment, Cassidy Plan. It would block grant a lot of these funds to the states and roll back the Medicaid expansion and other things. I think it's a long shot that we don't need to get into the procedural. There's procedural questions about whether they can do this before September 30th. And they haven't had it scored by the Congressional Budget Office, which generally tells us the expected effects of these different legislative proposals. But it's likely to be scored as a significant reduction in health insurance. And I think that we should acknowledge that for all of its warts, the Affordable Care Act has significantly shifted the dialogue about health care in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the polls are the public opinion polls show a really dramatic growth in the idea that healthcare is a human right, that coverage is something that should be guaranteed in one form or another from the government. This is, I think, in part the positive legacy of the Affordable Care Act that maybe we don't appreciate enough as we consider its blemishes.
One example of that is the Pew Research Center found in June that 60% of voters said the government has a responsibility to ensure access to healthcare, like you said, and that 33% of folks who Pew spoke with support single payer. But Josh, you write that we shouldn't be lulled into complacency. You mentioned this earlier in the show, because while polls support, you know, single payer popularity, that seems clear, forcing people to move to new systems is pretty much guaranteed to result in resistance. And then you also go on to write that that doesn't even consider the inevitable attacks from the conservative echo chamber in the media that will turn, for example, money for voluntary end-of-life counseling into, quote, death panels, which was never actually a thing, but is still being repeated now on the House and Senate floor. It's pretty incredible. What do you make of Senator Al Franken's comment that he and Bernie Sanders are trying to do bipartisan policy work in the Senate Health Committee? Is that just a good soundbite, or do you think there is actually any potential for some bipartisanship on this issue?
Well, I think there is absolutely the potential. I'm not optimistic that there could be some limited action to shore up the individual exchanges. And to some extent, that reflects the political reality that although this is not a universally held belief, many Republicans understand that given unified control of government, if the Affordable Care Act exchanges were to collapse, if that system were to really go under and leave a lot of people uninsured, they would own the political consequences of that. That means that there is a chance that they will move to some sort of bipartisan accord whereby they can give their base something in exchange for shoring up those exchanges, which are not unraveling, right? There is no death spiral, but they are stressed, and it is stress that could be relieved with relatively little effort from Congress. It all comes down to the politics. But I can't say that I'm optimistic. It's very unpredictable where the White House is on any of these issues.
Or
it changes
just
from
about
day
any
to day.
Issue. Right.
And I think that you would have a real backlash from the right flank and the Republican base if they didn't handle that in a very cautious way. So I'm not sure that, I wouldn't count myself as optimistic, but it is possible.
Well, and then Ross, what about the state and local level? For example, our governor, John Hickenlooper, has, for example, brought a Kaiser executive on to be his lieutenant governor, who now is running for governor in Colorado. But Hickenlooper has been very publicly touting collaboration with John Kasich, the Republican governor of Ohio. Is there a role for the states to play? And you've been on some committees and things in the state level. What do you see? I mean, the legislature sure didn't have any solutions this past session.
Yeah, I think the states are our best shot of actually trying to transform healthcare delivery to improve quality and control cost. Although we in our state, which is a pretty purple state, have been trying a lot of these ideas out in our state legislature last year. In fact, the Western Slope put forward four different bills that would work to improve quality and control costs, and they all died in the Senate Kill Committee at the state level, because as Joshua points out in his article, and we know is a reality at the federal level and at the state level, there are powerful lobbying interests at play that don't want to lose profit margin at the end of the day. I love the charts in Joshua's article that talk about the percentage of funds spent in private coverage, public coverage, and then what individuals pick up on that. I think that's pretty stark when you look at all other nations. And I think the call for us is to move more of what we deliver into a public good, delivered in a nonprofit fashion. I think if we can push the envelope on that and move in that direction, that's positive movement forward. At the state level, though, there are many states that are working on investing in primary care, investing in behavioral health services, investing in public health, preventative care, basic education and schooling to keep people out of the hospital unnecessarily and to keep costs down. So I'm heartened by the progress I see in Colorado and Oregon and Minnesota and New York and in other places where those pilots are happening and we're pushing that forward. But we got to keep pushing it forward to make real change.
That's Ross Brooks, CEO of Mountain Family Health, who's with me here in the studios at KD&K. You can find more at mountainfamily.org, and we will link to his great editorial from the Post-Independent, which was called Gutting Health Insurance for the Poor Will Not Improve the System, at our website, kdnk.org. And on the phone, Joshua Holland, contributor to Nation Magazine and Rolling Stone, who hosts the Politics and Reality radio show. We got this whole show together based on his fantastic piece for the Nation Magazine last month, warning that while the healthcare debate is moving to the left, progressives need to sweat the details or we will fail yet again. Thank you so much for taking some time, Joshua Holland. And I know you're going to see Willie Nelson perform tonight. Is that right?
I am indeed. I'm suffering from a bit of a cold and bronchitis, but I'm gonna suffer.
Well,
suffer through it for Willie.
Yeah, Ross and I are going to hope to live vicariously. And I know Diane Johnson, the host of Senior Matters, who couldn't be here today, she would love to be with you at that show, too. So maybe send us a photo.
I sure will. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, Joshua Holland, we'll link to his story and his radio show at kdnk.org. That's it for Senior Matters. Stay tuned. It's KDNK's membership drive. Love to have your support. Go to kdnk.org and click donate. Thanks a lot, Ross.
Thanks, Gavin.